still showed in maroon constellations that marred large areas of the floor and speckled some of the few still standing sculpture top plinths that lined both sides of the long hallway. Even if he had killed Sidious, even if he had won the war single-handedly for the Republic, the Jedi would have fought him to the bitter end. They might even have insisted on taking custody of his and Padme's child, for their offspring would have been powerful in the Force indeed, perhaps beyond measure. If only the High Council Masters hadn't been so set in their ways, so deceived by their own pride, they would have grasped that the Jedi needed to be brought down. Like the Republic itself, their order had grown stale, self-serving, corrupt. And yet, if the High Council had seen fit to recognize his power, had granted him the status of Master, perhaps he could have abided their continued existence. But to call him the Chosen One only to hold him back, to lie to him and expect him to lie for them, what did they imagine the outcome would be? Old fools. He understood now why they had discouraged use of the dark side. Because they had feared losing the power base they enjoyed, even though enslavement to attachment was what had helped pull down the Sith. The Jedi had been conspirators in their own downfall, complicit in the reemergence of the dark side, and as important to its victory as Sidious had been. Sidious, their ally. Attachment to power was the downfall of all orders, because most beings were incapable of controlling power, and power ended up controlling them. That, too, had been the cause of the galaxy's tip into disorder, the reason for Sidious's effortless rise to the top. Vader's heart pounded in his chest, and the respirator fed his heart's needs with rapid breaths. For his own health and sanity, he realized that he would have to avoid places that whipped his anger into such frenzy. The recognition that he would probably never be able to set foot on Naboo or Tatooine tore an anguished moan from him that toppled the rest of the plinths as if they were dominoes, leaving their crowning bronzium busts sliding and spinning across the polished, blood-flecked floor. Hollowed by the mournful outpouring, he supported himself against the broken column for what seemed an eternity. The chirping of the comlink on his belt returned him to the present, and after a long moment, he activated it. From the device's small speaker issued the urgent voice of the Internal Security Bureau Chief, Armand Isard, communicating from the temple's data room. Someone, Isard reported, was attempting remote access of the Jedi Beacon databanks. In the dimly lighted corridor of a forlorn separatist facility far across the stars, Shrine stopped to gaze at one of the niched statues that lined both walls. 6 meters high and exquisitely carved in the round, the statue was equal parts humanoid and winged beast. While it might have been modeled on an actual creature, the deliberate vagueness of its facial features suggested some mythical creature from antiquity. The indistinct visage was partly concealed by a hooded robe that fell to taloned feet. Identical statues stood in identical recesses for as far as Shrine could see in the wan light. The complex of ancient geometric structures the Separatists had converted into a communications facility had certainly stood on Jaguita's moon for thousands of standard years, perhaps tens of thousands of years. The moon was arid Jaguita's sole companion in a desolate system slave to a dying star, far from major hyperlanes. The fact that remote Jaguita should host a garrison of clone troopers in the desert planet's modest population center struck Shrine as something of a mystery. But the troopers' presence could owe to plans to salvage the Separatist war machines that had been left abandoned on the moon, as troopers were known to be doing in numerous Outer Rim systems. This wasn't the first time Jula and her band of smugglers had visited the moon, but the secrecy that had attended the recent arrival had less to do with prior knowledge of the terrain than to the drunk dancer's jamming capabilities. The ship had inserted into stationary orbit on the moon's far side without being detected by the Imperial troops in Jaguita, leaving Shrine, Starstone, and Jula, along with some of the crew members and Jedi, to ride down the well in the dropship, slipping into the moon's thin atmosphere like a sabacc card up a gambler's sleeve. Heaped with windblown sand, the facility's retrofitted landing platform appeared not to have seen use in several years. Shrine's estimate was borne out by the fact that the hundreds of deactivated droids that welcomed the dropship party were early-generation Trade Federation infantry droids, of the sort controlled by centralized computers rather than super-battle droids equipped with autonomous droid brains. Access to the structure that housed the communications center hadn't been a problem, since whatever remote transmissions deactivated the droids had silenced the facility as well. The power generators, however, were still functional, and Philly Bitters and Isle Dix had been able to override the deactivation codes and bring some of the internal illuminators to life, along with the hyperwave transceiver the Jedi were intent on using to slice into the Temple Beacon database. Shrine had left the slicers, Starstone, and some of the other Jedi to what he regarded as their business, and had been wandering the aged corridors ever since, thinking through his dilemma. Even this deep into the complex, the ceramicrete floors were covered with sand and bits of other inorganic debris carried in by the moon's constant, nerve-wracking winds. To Shrine, the combination of wind and gloom couldn't have been more apropos to puzzling out whether his coming to Jaguda was in accord with the will of the Force, or merely symptomatic of a deep denial of the truth. Yet another attempt to convince himself that his actions had some import. Perhaps if he hadn't recognized in Starstone and the other Jedi a powerful need to believe, a need to hold on to something in the wake of all that had been snatched from them, he might have tried harder to discourage them. But their need wasn't enough to keep him from asking himself whether this was the way he wanted to spend the rest of his days, hanging on to a dream that the Jedi Order could be reassembled, that a handful of Jedi could mount an insurgency against as formidable an enemy as Emperor Palpatine. For the time being, he was willing to remain with Starstone, if not mentor her. That was an entirely different problem. Starstone and the others were looking to him for leadership he simply couldn't provide, in part because leadership had never been his strength, but more because the war had eroded whatever measure of self-confidence he had once possessed. He'd begun to move deeper into the corridor when Jula appeared out of the gloom, a luma in hand, and fell into step beside him. "We're the guides when you need them," she said. "Just what I was thinking." She had her jacket folded over her arm, a blaster holstered on her hip. "How are they doing back there?" he asked, nodding with his chin toward the communications room. "Well, Philly's already sliced into the beacon. No surprises there. Now I suppose it's a matter of worming into the database itself." She regarded Shrine while they walked. "You're not interested in being there when they start downloading the names and possible whereabouts of your scattered Confederates?" Shrine shook his head. "Starstone and Forte can see to that. My credits aren't on their succeeding anyway." Jula laughed. "Then you won't get any side action from me." She looked at him askance. "Oli and Philly are two of a kind, don't you think?" "I did for a while. But I figure she's already found her life partner." "The Force, you mean?" Jula forced an exhale. "That's dedication of a scary sort." Shrine stopped walking and turned to her. "Why'd you say yes to taking us here, Jula?" She smiled lightly. "I thought I'd made myself clear. I'm still hoping to convince you to join us." Scanning his face for clues, she asked, "Any movement at all on that front?" "I don't know what I'm thinking. But you'll keep me updated." Distant rumblings overpowered Shrine's response. In one swift action, he drew and ignited the lightsaber clipped to his belt. Jula raised her brows in surprise. "Where'd you come by that?" "It belonged to the master of one of the Padawans." Spinning on his heel, he began to race back toward the communications control room, Jula right behind him. Shrine realized that the rumbling sounds were being made by doors and hatchways opening and closing. He hastened his pace, weaving through stands of deactivated battle droids. In the control room, Philly, his spiked hair matted to his skull, was doing furious input at a console, while Isle Dix and Starstone paced behind him. Oli, gnawing away at her lower lip. A few meters away, Jedi Knights Forte and Iwokulka looked as if they were having second thoughts about what they had set in motion. "Philly, what's going on?" Jula shouted. The slicer's right hand pointed to Starstone, while his left continued to fly across the keys of a control pad. "She told me to do it!" "Do what?" Shrine said, looking from Starstone to Philly and back again.
"Boost the transceiver with a burst from the power generator,"
Dix answered for Philly.
"We didn't have enough juice to download from the database," Starstone said. "I thought it would be fine."
Shrine's forehead wrinkled in confusion.
"So, what's the problem?" "The generator wants to reactivate the entire facility," Philly said in a rush of words. "I can't get it to shut down!"
Slamming, hissing sounds began to replace the rumble of sliding doors. Jula looked sharply at Shrine.
"This entire place is sealing up."
A series of determined clicks and ready tones punctuated the din raised by descending hatches. All at once, every battle droid in the control room powered up. Swinging its thin head toward him and raising its blaster rifle, the battle droid standing closest to Shrine said,
"Intruders."
Behind Armand Isard and the two Internal Security Bureau technicians seated at the Temple Beacon control console, Vader stood with his arms folded across his chest. Commander Apo at his right hand.
"I want to know how the beacon was accessed," Vader said.
"By means of a Jedi transceiver, Lord Vader," the tech closest to Armand said.
"Cross-check the transceiver code with the identity database," the ISB chief said, anticipating Vader.
"The name should be coming up in a moment," the other tech said, eyes glued to rapidly scrolling text on one of the display screens.
"Chetak," he added a moment later. "Bol Chetak."
The sound of Vader's breathing filled the ensuing silence. Shrine and Starstone, he thought. Obviously, they'd been in possession of Chetak's beacon transceiver when they'd evaded him at Morkana. Now they were attempting to determine the location of other Jedi when Order 66 had been issued. Certainly they were hoping to establish contact with survivors, hoping to pick up the pieces of their shattered order.
"What is the source of the transmission?"
"The Jaguda system, Lord Vader," the first technician said. "More precisely, the moon of the system's only inhabited world."
A large hollow map of the galaxy emerged from the console's holoprojector. The hollow map began to close tighter and tighter on a remote area of the outer rim. When finally the Jaguda system hung in midair, Vader strode into its midst.
"This moon," he said,
gesturing with the forefinger of his black-gloved hand.
"Yes, Lord Vader," the tech said.
Vader glanced at Apo, who had already comlinked central operations on Coruscant.
"The moon is the site of an abandoned separatist communications facility," Apo said. "Whoever is in possession of the Jedi transceiver must have brought the facility's hyperspace communications network online."
"Do we have any vessels in that sector, Commander?"
"No vessels, Lord Vader," Apo said. "But there is a small Imperial garrison on Jaguda."
"Instruct the garrison commander to scramble his troopers immediately."
"Capture or kill, Lord Vader."
"Either would please me."
The lightsaber Klossi Ano had given Shrine felt foreign in his hand, but it was finely wrought, and its dense blue blade was perfect for deflecting the hail of blaster bolts the battle droids had unleashed. Beside him, Jula was firing steadily and with impressive accuracy, dropping those droids Shrine's parried bolts didn't. Crouched behind the control console, Philly and Dix were somehow managing to continue entering commands on the keyboards, while the flashing lightsabers of Starstone, Forte, and Kulka provided cover. In the control room and elsewhere in the facility, alert sirens were warbling, lights were flashing, and hatchways were sealing.
"Whatever you did, undo it,"
Shrine said to Philly, without missing a blaster bolt.
"Deactivate the droids!"
A glance at display screens that had been sleeping moments earlier showed that scores of infantry droids and droidicas were hurrying toward the control center from all areas of the complex.
Philly, hurry!
Jula added for emphasis.
More are headed this way!
Shrine took a moment to look around the control room. The doorway through which he and Jula had entered was one of three, positioned 120 degrees from one another.
Philly! Can you seal us in here?
He shouted.
Probably!
The slicer yelled back.
But we may have bigger troubles!
We can handle the droidicas,
Forte assured him. Philly raised his head above the console and shook it negatively.
Someone at the temple knows that we've sliced in!
Starstone whirled on him.
How do you...
We're getting an echo from the beacon,
Isle Dix explained. Redirecting a flurry of bolts, Shrine reduced six droids to shrapnel.
How long before the temple ascertains our location?
Depends on who's at the other end, Philly said.
Then cancel the link,
Jula said.
We're still downloading,
Starstone said.
We need all the data we can get.
Shrine glowered at her.
What good is all the data in the temple if we're not around to put it to use?
She narrowed her eyes. I knew you'd say that.
Do it, Philly,
she said over her shoulder.
Zero the link.
Glancing apologetically at Forte and Kulka, she added,
We'll make the best of what we have. Done,
Philly announced. Shrine's deflection shot dismantled another droid.
Now shut the power down before we're shot to death or entombed in here!
A moment later, the droids returned to their inert status, and the control room was plunged into darkness. Five lumas provided just enough light to see by.
I trust that someone knows the way out of here,
Forte said.
I do,
Dick said, her antennae standing straight up.
Then let's hope the exit's still open,
Shrine said. Philly nodded.
It is. I gotta look at the security screen before we cut the power.
Good job, Shrine started to say, when blaster fire erupted from somewhere outside the control room.
You said you zeroed it, Philly,
Jula snapped. He spread his arms in confusion.
I did!
Shrine listened closely to the distant discharges.
Those aren't droid blasters, he said after a moment. Those are DC-15s.
Starstone stared at him.
Stormtroopers? Here?
Jula's comlink chimed and she grabbed for it.
Archer, she said for everyone's benefit.
Captain, we've got company,
Archer said from the dropship.
Troopers from the Jaguda garrison.
Shrine traded looks with Starstone.
Whoever's at the temple didn't waste any time, she said.
Shrine nodded. They must have been monitoring us from the start.
How many troopers?
Jula was asking Archer.
A couple of squads, he said. Skek and I are pinned down on the landing platform, but most of the troopers have headed inside.
I can try to seal the entrances, Philly said.
No, don't!
Shrine cut him off.
You think you can rig a delay to the power generator?
His luma grasped in his teeth. Philly began to riffle through his toolkit.
I'm sure I can cobble something together,
he said. Shrine turned to Jula. How long will it take us to reach the front entrance, closest to the cliffs? She threw him a questioning look.
That'll dump us way down valley, Roan, a good kilometer from the dropship.
He nodded.
But we avoid engaging troopers on the way out.
Her brow continued to furrow.
Then why do you want Philly to...
She grinned in sudden revelation and turned to Philly.
Set it to power up in a standard quarter, Philly.
That's cutting things pretty close, Captain.
The closer the better, she said.
By the time the holotransmission from the commander of the Jaguda garrison reached the temple beacon room, Vader already knew that something had gone wrong.
I'm sorry, Lord Vader,
the helmeted stormtrooper was saying.
But we're trapped inside the facility with several hundred reactivated infantry and destroyer droids.
The commander dodged blaster bolts and returned fire at something distant from the holocam's transmission grid.
All access is sealed when the facility powered up.
Where are the Jedi?
Vader asked.
They left before the facility went online. We're trapped in here until we find a way to blow one of the doors.
Did you destroy the ship the Jedi arrived in?
Negative,
the commander said, as bolts lanced the air around him.
The smugglers detonated a mag pulse while the second squad was advancing. My troopers were expecting it, but in the time it took our hardware to reboot, the Jedi got their ship airborne.
Off-cam, a trooper said,
Fallback positions 2 and 3 have been overrun, Commander. We'll have to make a stand here. There's just too many of them!
The commander said, as diagonal lines of noise began to interfere with the transmission. Abruptly, it derezzed completely. Armand Iser and the ISB technicians busied themselves at the beacon controls, if only to avoid having to look at Vader. The drunk dancer tore through mottled hyperspace, leaving desolate Jaguda light years behind. Skek had sustained a nasty blaster burn to his right arm during the trooper's attempt to disable the dropship, but no one else had been hurt. Emerging from the facility, moments before Philly's time delay initiated the power generator, Shrine and the others had raced up valley to the landing platform and had arrived in time to catch a squad of Imperials in a crossfire. Sealed inside the facility, the remaining squads were up to their T-visors in reactivated battle droids. After Skek's wound had been bandaged, Shrine had retired to the dormitory cabin space Jula had provided for the Jedi. He had always had a fondness for hyperspace travel, more the sense of being outside time, and was kneeling in meditation when he sensed Starstone approaching the cabin. Simultaneous with her excited entry, he rose to his feet, eyes on the sheaf of flimsy plastic printouts she was holding. "We have data on hundreds of Jedi," she said, rattling the printouts. "We know where more than 70 masters were at the end of the war, when the clone commanders received their orders." Accepting the proffered flimsies, Shrine thumbed through them, then glanced at Starstone. "How many of these hundreds do you think might actually have survived the attacks?" She gave her head a quick shake. "I'm not even going to try to guess. We can begin our search with systems closest to Mosak, and fan out from there toward Mygeeto, Seleukumi, and Kashyyyk." Shrine took the flimsies. "Has it occurred to you that if we have this information, then so does the Empire? What do you think our adversaries were doing in the Temple Beacon Room? Playing hide-and-seek?" Starstone winced at the harshness of his tone, but only briefly. "Has it occurred to you that our adversaries, as you call them, were there precisely because a good many Jedi survived? It's crucial that we reach those survivors before they're hunted down. Or are you proposing that we leave them to the Empire, to Vader and the Stormtroopers?" Shrine made a start at replying, then bit back his words and motioned to the edge of the nearest cot. "Sit down and try for a moment to stop thinking like a HoloNet hero." When Starstone ultimately lowered herself to the cot, Shrine sat opposite her. "Don't misunderstand me," he began. "Your goal couldn't be more noble. And for all I know, there are 500 Jedi scattered throughout the Rim in need of rescue. My point is, I don't want to see your name added to the casualty list. What happened at Jaguda is only a foretaste of what's in store for us if we continue to band together." Shrine stopped her before she could go on. "Think about the final beacon message we received at Murkana. The message didn't tell us to gather together and coordinate a strike on Coruscant or on Palpatine or even on the troopers. It instructed us, each of us who received it, to hide. Yoda or whoever ordered the transmission knew that the Jedi were in a fight we couldn't win. The message was a way of saying just that, that the order is over and done with, that the Jedi are finished." He hid his ruefulness. "Does that mean that you have to stop honoring the Force? Of course not. All of us will live out our lives honoring the Force. But not with lightsabers in hand, Oli. With right action and right thinking. I'd rather die honoring the Force with my lightsaber, she said. He had expected as much. How is dying honoring the Force when you could be out doing good works, passing on to others all that you've learned about the Force? Is that what you plan to do? Devote yourself to good works? Shrine smiled. Right now, I only know what I'm not going to do, and that's help rush you into a grave on some remote world. He held her gaze. I'm sorry, but I've already lost 2 Padawans to this rotten war, and I don't want to lose you to it. Even though I'm not your learner? He nodded. Even though. She sighed with purpose. I appreciate your concern for me, Master. And I will call you that because right now you're the only Master we have. But the Force tells me that we can make a difference, and I can't turn my back on that. Master Shatak instilled in me every day that I should follow the Force's lead, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. She adopted an even more serious look. Jula believes that you can turn your back. The Force is with her, Master, but she's not a Jedi. You can't unlearn overnight the teachings and practices of decades. Even if you should succeed, you'll regret it. Shrine firmed his lips and nodded again. Then you and I will be parting ways at Mosak. Sadness pulled down the corners of her mouth. I wish it didn't have to be this way, Master. That doesn't begin to say how I feel about it. They stood, and he hugged her tenderly. You'll tell the others? He said, while she was gathering up the flimsies. They already know. Shrine didn't watch her leave, but no sooner did she exit the cabin than Jula entered. Jedi business? Shrine looked at her. You can probably figure it out. Jula averted her gaze. Oli's a fine young woman. They're all decent beings. But they're deluded, Roan. It's over. They have to realize that and get on with their lives. You told me that attachment is the root of many of our problems. Well, that includes being so attached to the Jedi Order that you can't leave it behind. If being a Jedi means being able to accept what has happened and move on, then they honor the Order best by letting go. She reached for his hands. They took you from me once, Roan. I won't let you go a second time without a fight. She laughed lightly. And that, ladies and gentlemen, concludes my little speech. Gazing at him, she said, Join us. In crime, you mean? A fire came into her eyes. We're not criminals. All right, we've done some questionable things, but so have you. And that was in the past. If you come aboard, I promise we'll stick to taking contracts that will allow you to keep on doing good deeds, if that's what it's going to take. Such as? Shrine said. Well, we already happen to have a good deed on deck. A contract to transport a former senator from the Corps to his home system. Shrine allowed his skepticism to show. Why would a former senator have to be smuggled to his home system? I don't have all the details, but my guess? The senator doesn't share the ideals of a new regime. Is this a Cash Garulan contract? Jula nodded. And maybe that's another reason for you to say yes to accepting the offer. Because you owe him for arranging for your escape from Rakana. Shrine pretended scorn. I don't owe Cash any favors. Okay, then you'll do it to honor his memory. Shrine stared at her. Imperial troopers caught up with him soon after all of you left Mercana. Cash is dead. From the high-backed chair that was his seat of power, Sidious watched Darth Vader turn and march from the throne room, long black cloak whooshing. black helmet burnished by the lights, anger palpable.
What is to be done with him?
Sidious thought.
Perhaps I will have to send him back to Mustafar as well.
He mused on a strategy for a moment. Then, depressing a button on the control panel set into the arm of the chair, he summoned Mas Amida into the room. The tall-horned Shigrian, now the Emperor's interface with sundry, utterly dispensable senatorial groups, moved cautiously between the Imperial guards who flanked the door, inclining his head in a bow of respect as he approached Sidious. Through the open door to the waiting room, Sidious glimpsed a familiar face.
Is that Isard outside?
Yes, my lord.
Why is he here?
He asked that I inform you of an incident that occurred while he and Lord Vader were in the temple.
Indeed.
I'm given to understand that unknown parties accessed certain databases by means of the beacon.
Jedi,
Sidious said, drawing out the word.
None other, my lord.
And Lord Vader was on hand to witness this remote infiltration?
He was, my lord. Once the source of the transmission was located, Lord Vader ordered a local garrison of troopers to descend on the Jedi responsible.
The troopers failed,
Sidious said, leaning forward in interest. Mas Amida nodded gravely.
More of his fugitive Jedi, Sidious thought. He has not allowed himself to be done with them. No matter,
he said at last.
What business originally brought you here?
Senator Fang Zhar, my lord.
Sidious interlocked the fingers of his fat hands and sat back in the chair.
One of the more vocal of the illustrious 2000 who wished to see me removed from office. Has he had a sudden change of heart?
Of a sort. You will recall, my lord, that following your announcement that the war had been won, Fang Zhar and several other signatories of the Petition of the 2000 were briefly detained for questioning by Internal Security Bureau officers.
Come to the point, Sidious snapped.
Fang Zhar was instructed not to leave Coruscant, and yet he did, managing to reach Alderaan, where he has been in residence at the Aldera Palace ever since. Now, however, the conflict that engulfed his home system has come to an end, and Fang Zhar is apparently determined to return to Cern Prime without attracting the notice of the ISB or anyone else.
Sidious considered it.
How is Zhar planning to reach Cern Prime without, as you say, attracting attention?
We know that he made contact with a crime lord on Mercana.
Mercana?
Yes, my lord. Perhaps he wishes to avoid involving Senator Organa in his predicament.
Sidious fell silent for a long moment, attuned to the currents of the Force. Currents linking Vader and Mercana, and now Zhar and Mercana, and perhaps fugitive Jedi and Mercana.
Into his thoughts came the words of Darth Plagueis. Tell me what you regard as your greatest strength, so I will know how best to undermine you. Tell me of your greatest fear, so I will know which I must force you to face. Tell me what you cherish most, so I will know what to take from you. And tell me what you crave, so that I might deny you.
Perhaps it would be more prudent for Fang Zhar to remain on Alderaan a while longer, he said finally.
Mas Amida bowed his head.
Shall I inform Senator Organa of your wish?
No. Lord Vader should deal with the situation.
To deflect his hunger for the Jedi,
the Shigrian risked saying. Sidious shot him a look.
To sharpen it.
Perhaps it was because Alderaan presented such a pleasant picture from deep space that it had enjoyed such a long history of peace, prosperity, and tolerance.
even deeper into its intoxicating atmosphere, closer to its montage of alabaster clouds, blue seas, and green plains, the picture held. Coruscant's neighbor in the core was a gem of a world. The Pacific impression didn't begin to diminish until one reached street level on the island city of Aldera. And only then, as a result of the day's activities, which demonstrated that for tolerance to endure, voice had to be granted to all, even when free expression challenged the perpetuation of peace. Bail Organa understood this, as had its predecessors in the Galactic Senate. But Bail's compassion for those who'd taken to Aldera's narrow streets was not a case of noblesse oblige, for he shared the concerns of the demonstrators and had deep sympathy for their cause. As many said of Bail, were it not for genetics, he might have been a Jedi. And indeed, for most of his adult life, he had been a valued friend of the Order. He stood in plain sight of the crowds, on a balcony of the Royal Palace, in the heart of Aldera, which itself lay in the embrace of green mountains, their gentle summits sparkling with freshly fallen snow. Below him marched hundreds of thousands of demonstrators, refugees representing scores of species displaced by the war, bundled up in colorful clothing against the mountain's frigid downdrafts. Many of the refugees had been in Alderaan since the earliest days of the separatist movement, living in housing Alderaan had provided. Many more were recently arrived on planet to show their support. Now that the war had ended, almost all of them were eager to return to their home systems, pick up the pieces of their shattered lives, and reunite with members of their widely dispersed families. But the Empire was attempting to thwart them. While little of the angry chanting was directed at Alderaan's government, or Queen Briha, Bail's wife, many in the crowd were looking to Bail to intercede with Palpatine on their behalf. Alderaan was merely their gathering place. After the demonstration's organizers had decided against holding the march on Coruscant, under the watchful gaze of stormtroopers, and with the memory of what had happened at the Jedi Temple fresh in everyone's mind. Demonstrators were nothing new in any case. Alderaanians were known throughout the galaxy for their missions of mercy and their unstinting support of oppressed groups. With his home world thoroughly politicized, Bail had been forced to play a careful game in the galactic capital, where he was at once an advocate for refugee populations and a principal member of the Loyalist Committee, that is, loyal to the Constitution and to the Republic for which it stood. A reasonable man, one of a handful of rankled delegates who had found themselves caught between support for Palpatine and outright contention, Bail had understood that political wrangling was the only way to introduce change. As a result, he and Palpatine had engaged in numerous disputes, openly in the Rotunda as well as in private, on issues relating to Palpatine's rapid rise to incontestable power and the subsequent slow but steady erosion of personal liberties. Only with the war's sudden and shocking end had Bail come to understand that what had seemed political maneuvering on Palpatine's part had been nothing less than inspired machination. The unfolding of a diabolical scheme to prolong the war and to so frustrate the Jedi that when they finally sought to hold him accountable for refusing to proclaim the war concluded with the deaths of Count Dooku and General Grievous, Palpatine could not only declare them traitors to the Republic, but also pronounce them guilty of having fomented the war to serve their own ends, and therefore deserving of execution. Ever since, Bail had been forced to play an even more treacherous game on Coruscant, Imperial Center, for he now knew Palpatine to be a more dangerous opponent than anyone suspected. Indeed, a more dangerous foe than most could even begin to guess. While senators, such as Mon Mothma and Garm Bel Iblis, were expecting Bail to join in their attempts to mount a secret rebellion, circumstance compelled him to maintain a low profile and to demonstrate greater allegiance to Palpatine than he ever had. That circumstance was Leia, and Bail's fears for her safety had only increased since his close encounter with Darth Vader on Coruscant. He had spoken of the encounter only to Ramus Antilles, captain of the consular ship Tantive IV. Antilles had been given custody of Anakin's protocol and astromech droids, C-3PO and R2-D2. The former had undergone a memory wipe to safeguard the truth for as long as necessary, and to assure the continued protection of the Skywalker twins. Could Vader actually be Anakin Skywalker? The two men wondered. Based on Obi-Wan's account of what had occurred on Mustafar, Anakin's survival didn't seem possible. But perhaps Obi-Wan had underestimated Anakin. Perhaps Anakin's peerless strength in the Force had allowed him to survive. Was Bail then raising the child of a man who was still alive? Standing at the edge of the balcony, the object of shouts, appeals, chants, and flurries of raised fists, Bail ran his hand over his mouth, hoping that the Force was with him.
"Senator!"
someone called from behind him. Bail turned and saw Captain Antilles hurrying toward him from the direction of the palace's grand reception room. Accompanying Antilles were two of Bail's aides, Sheltray Retrack and Solana Aldreet. Antilles directed Bail's attention to a nearby holoprojector.
"You're not going to be pleased," the starship captain said by way of warning.
The hollow image of an enormous warship resolved in the projector's blue field. Bail's brow wrinkled in confoundment.
"Imperator-class Star Destroyer," Antilles explained. "Hot off the line. And now parked in stationary orbit above Alderaan."
"This is outrageous," Solana Aldreet said. "Even Palpatine wouldn't be so bold as to interfere in our affairs."
"Don't fool yourself," Bail said. "He would, and he has."
He swung to Antilles.
"Calm the vessel," he ordered,
as Alderaan's vizier and other advisors were hastening onto the balcony to gawk at the projected holo image. Before Antilles could activate his comlink, the holo projector image faded and was replaced by the pinched, clean-shaven face of Palpatine's chief henchman, Sate Pestage.
"Senator Organa,"
Pestage said,
"will you grant permission for our shuttle to land, Senator?"
"How unlike you to extend us the courtesy of a warning, Sate. What brings you to this part of the core, in a Star Destroyer, no less?"
Pestage smiled without showing his teeth.
"I'm merely a passenger aboard the Exactor, Senator. As to our business here, well, let me say first how much I've enjoyed watching holonet feeds of your political rally."
"It's a peaceful gathering, Sate," Bail fired back. "And it's likely to remain so unless your agitators succeed in doing what they do best."
Pestage adopted a surprised look.
"My agitators? You can't be serious."
"I'm very serious. But suppose you get back to telling me why you're here."
Pestage tugged at his lower lip.
"Now that I think about it, Senator, it might be more prudent for me to leave the explanation to the Emperor's emissary."
Bail stood akimbo.
"That has always been your position, Sate."
"No longer, Senator. I now answer to a superior."
"Who are you talking about?"
"Someone you've not yet had the pleasure of meeting. Darth Vader."
"And this Darth Vader is coming here,"
Bail said in a composed voice.
"Our shuttle should be setting down momentarily. Assuming, of course, that we have your permission to land."
Bail nodded for the holocam. "I'll see to it that you receive approach and landing coordinates."
Pestage's holo image had no sooner de-resolved than Bail snatched his comlink from his belt and tapped a code into the keypad. To the female voice that answered, he said,
"Where are Breeha and Leia?"
"I believe they're already on their way to join you, sir,"
the Queen's attendant said.
"Do you know if Breeha has her comlink with her?"
"I don't believe she does, sir."
"Thank you."
Bail silenced the comlink and turned to his aides.
"Find the Queen. She must be somewhere in the main residence. Tell her that she is not to leave the residence under any circumstances, and that she is to contact me as soon as possible. Is that understood?"
Retrack and Aldreet nodded, spun on their heels, and hurried off. Bail swung to Antilles, eyes bulging in concern.
"Are the droids on the Tantive IV or downside?"
"Here,"
Antilles said, exhaling.
Somewhere in the palace or on the grounds. Bale tightened his lips. They have to be located and kept out of sight.
Never was one for crowds myself, Skek said, as he, Archer, and Shrine were negotiating Alderaan's throng of demonstrators.
Is that what first took you to the Outer Rim? Shrine asked.
Skek mocked the idea with a motion of dismissal.
I just hang there for the food.
In addition to keeping out the cold, their long coats, hats, and high boots supplied hiding places for blasters and other tools of the smuggling trade. Jula, Broody, and Isle Dix had remained with the dropship, which was docked in a circular bay a couple of kilometers west of the palace. It was Shrine's first visit to Alderaan. From what little he had seen, the planet lived up to its reputation as both a beautiful world and an arena for political dissent, notwithstanding Alderaan's allegedly pacifist views. The mood of the enormous crowd, made up of war refugees and those who'd arrived from countless worlds to demonstrate their solidarity, seemed to be in keeping with those views. But Shrine had already zeroed in on scores of beings who clearly hoped to provoke the marchers to violence, perhaps as a means of being assured extensive holonet coverage and thus making their point with Palpatine. Or maybe, just maybe, Alderaan had the Emperor himself to thank for the rabble-rousers. Shrine, Skek, and Archer had already circled the palace twice, primarily to scope out potential problems at the South Gate entrance, where the prearranged meet was supposed to take place. Shrine found it interesting that Zar's ostensible reason for making a low-key departure was to keep from involving Organa in his problems. But Shrine wasn't clear on just what those problems were. Both Zar and Organa had been outspoken members of the Loyalist Committee, so what could Zar have done to cause problems for himself that didn't already involve Organa? Was he in a fix with Palpatine? Shrine tried to convince himself that Zar's troubles were none of his business, that the sooner he accustomed himself to simply executing a job, the better, for him and for Jula. This, as opposed to thinking like a Jedi, which involved looking to the Force as a means of gauging possible repercussions and ramifications of his actions. In that sense, the Alderaan mission was the first day of the rest of his life. Olee Starstone was the only other issue he had to clear from his mind. In response to Shrine's decision to follow his own path, she was about as angry as a Jedi was allowed to be, though some of the other Jedi had said that they understood. All seven had taken the battered transport and gone in search of surviving Jedi. Shrine feared it would just be a matter of time before they got themselves in serious trouble, but he wasn't about to serve as their watchdog. More to the point, they had seen the risks they were taking as flowing from the will of the Force. Well, who knew for sure? Shrine wasn't omniscient. Maybe they would succeed against all odds. Maybe the Jedi, in league with political protesters and sympathetic military commanders, could bring Palpatine to justice for what he had done. Unlikely, but a possibility nevertheless. Jula had been generous enough to loan Philly to the Jedi, outwardly to help them sort through the data they downloaded from the Beacon databases. Shrine suspected, however, that Jula's real intent was to disable Starstone's reckless determination. Through his comlink's wireless earpiece, Shrine heard Jula's voice.
I just heard from our bundle. He's in motion.
We're working our way around to him now, Shrine said into the audio pickup, fastened to the synth fur collar of his coat.
You sure you're going to be able to recognize him from the holo images?
Recognizing him won't be a problem, but finding him in this crowd could be.
I'm guessing he didn't expect this big a turnout.
I'm guessing no one did.
Does that say something for the Emperor's days being numbered?
Someone's days, anyway. Shrine paused, then said, Hold for a moment.
The palace's South Gate entrance was within sight now. But in the time it had taken Shrine, Skek, and Archer to complete their third circuit, a mob had formed. Three human speakers, standing atop repulsor-lit platforms, were urging everyone to press through the tall gates and onto the palace grounds. Anticipating trouble, a group of 40 or so royal troops, dressed in ceremonial armor and slack hats, had deployed themselves outside the gates, armed with an array of non-lethal crowd control devices, including sonic devices, shock batons, and stun nets.
Roan, what's going on?
Jula asked.
Things are getting rowdy. Everyone's being warned away from the South Gate entrance.
The crowd surged, and Shrine felt himself lifted from his feet and carried toward the palace. The cordon of troops issued a final warning. When the crowd surged again, two frontline guards, sporting backpack rigs, began to coat the cobblestone plaza with a thick layer of repellent foam. The crowd surged back in response, but dozens of demonstrators closest to the front failed to step back in time and were immediately immobilized in the rapidly spreading goo. A few of them were able to retreat by surrendering their footgear, but the rest were stuck fast. Shrine began to edge toward the perimeter, with Skekin Archer to either side of him. When he could, he enabled his comlink.
Jula, we're not going to be able to get to the gate.
Which also means that our bundle won't be able to exit the grounds that way.
Do we have a substitute rendezvous?
Roan, I've lost voice contact with him.
Probably temporary. When you hear from him, just tell him to stay put wherever he is.
Where will you be?
Shrine studied the palace's curved south wall.
Don't worry. We'll find a way in.
Those poor beings trapped in that terrible foam,
C-3PO said, as he and R2-D2 hastened for a narrow access door in the palace's south wall. Close to the palace's underground droid maintenance facility, where both droids had enjoyed an oil bath, the door was the same one they'd used to exit the palace grounds earlier that day, when the protesters were just beginning their march.
I think we'll be much better off inside the palace.
R2-D2 chittered a response. C-3PO tilted his head in bafflement.
What do you mean we've been ordered inside anyway? Ordered to conceal ourselves? By whom? Captain Antilles? How thoughtful of him to show concern for our well-being in the midst of this confusion.
By then, they'd reached the access door in the wall. R2-D2 extended a slender interface arm from one of the compartments in his squat, cylindrical torso, and was in the process of inserting it into a computer control terminal alongside the doorway, when the voice of a flesh and blood said,
"Misplace your starfighter, droid!"
Turning completely about, C-3PO found himself looking at a human and two six-fingered humanoids wearing long coats and tall boots. The human's left hand was patting R2-D2's dome of a head.
Oh, who are you?
Never mind that, one of the humanoids said.
Parting his coat, he revealed a blaster wedged into the wide belt that cinched his pants.
Do you know what this is?
R2-D2 mewled in distress. C-3PO's photoreceptors refocused.
Why, yes. It's a DL-13 ion blaster.
The humanoid smiled nastily.
You're very learned.
Sir, it is my fondest wish that my master recognizes much. Working with other droids has become so tiresome.
Ever see what an ionizer on full power can do to a droid?
The humanoid interrupted.
No, but I can well imagine.
Good, the human said. Then here's the way it's going to work. You're going to lead us into the palace like we're all the best of friends.
Vader stood at the foot of the shuttle's boarding ramp, gazing at the white spires of the royal palace. Commander Appo and six of his stormtroopers spread out to flank him, as Bail Organa and several others emerged from the ornate building. For a moment, neither group moved. Then Organa's contingent walked onto the landing platform and approached the shuttle.
You are Lord Vader? Organa asked.
Senator,
Vader said, inclining his head slightly.
I demand to know why you've come to Alderaan.
Senator, you are in no position to demand anything.
Organa introduced him to his aides and advisors, as well as to Captain Antilles, who commanded Alderaan's Corellian-made consular ship,
and who tried, but failed, to conceal an expression of profound hostility toward Vader.
If Antilles only knew who he was dealing with. From beyond the palace's walls came the sound of angry voices and chanting. Vader surmised that at least some of the turbulence owed to the presence of an Imperial shuttle on Alderaan. The thought entertained him. Vader listened to the sounds of the crowd for a moment more, then turned to regard Organa.
Why do you permit this?
Organa's restless eyes searched for something, perhaps a peek at the man behind the mask.
Are such demonstrations no longer permitted on Coruscant?
Harmony is the ideal of the New Order, Senator, not dissension.
When harmony becomes the standard for all, then protests will cease. What's more, by allowing voices to be heard here, Alderaan saves Coruscant any unmerited embarrassment.
There may be some truth to that. But in due time, protests will cease, one way or another.
Vader recognized that Organa was in a quandary about something. Clearly, he resented being challenged on his own world, but his tone of voice was almost conversational.
I trust that the Emperor knows better than to end them by fear, he was saying.
The Emperor would not be pleased by your lack of faith, Senator,
he said carefully.
Or by your willingness to allow others to display their distrust. But I haven't come to discuss your little march.
Organa fingered his short beard. What does bring you here?
Former Senator Fang Zar.
Organa seemed genuinely surprised. What of him?
Then you don't deny that he's here.
Of course not. He has been a guest of the palace for several weeks.
Are you aware that he fled Coruscant?
Organa frowned in uncertainty.
It sounds as if you're suggesting that he wasn't permitted to leave of his own free will. Was he under arrest?
Not arrest, Senator. Internal security had questions for him, some of which were left unanswered. ISB requested that he remain in Imperial Center until matters were resolved.
Organa shook his head once. I knew nothing of this.
No one is questioning your decision to house him, Senator.
Vader said, gazing down at him.
I simply want your assurance that you won't interfere with my escorting him back to Coruscant.
Back to? Organa left the rest of it unfinished and began again. I won't interfere. Except in one instance. Vader waited. If Senator Zar requests diplomatic immunity, Alderaan will grant it. Vader folded his arms across his chest.
I'm not certain that privilege still exists. Even if it does, you may find that refusing the Emperor's request is hardly in your best interest.
A nearby holo projector chimed, and from it emerged the holo image of a dark-haired woman with an infant in her arms.
Bail, I'm sorry I've been delayed,
the woman said.
I just wanted to let you know that I'll be there shortly.
Organa looked from Vader to the holo image and back again. As the image faded, he said, Perhaps it's better if you spoke with Senator Zar in person. He gulped and found his voice.
I'll have him escorted to the conference room as soon as possible.
Vader turned and waved a signal to Commander Apo, who nodded.
Who is the woman?
Vader asked Organa.
My wife, Organa said nervously. The Queen.
Vader regarded Organa, trying to read him more clearly.
Inform Senator Zar that I'm waiting. In the meantime, I would enjoy meeting the Queen.
More than 7 centuries old, the palace was a rambling and multi-storied affair of ramparts and turrets, bedrooms and ballrooms, with as many grand stairways as it had turbolifts. Without a map, its kilometers of winding corridors were nearly impossible to follow. And so, we're walking from the droid maintenance room to the hallway that accessed the south gate had seemed a simple matter. It was in fact akin to negotiating a maze.
The droid's more clever than it looks,
Archer said, when it finally dawned on them that the two machine intelligences had been walking them in circles for the past quarter hour.
I think it's leading us on a wild Gundark chase.
Oh, he would never do that, C-3PO said. Would you, R2?
When the astromech didn't